Actually, my earliest memory of home, and it's probably because it wasn't traumatic for me because I didn't understand it, but it was quite a shock for a child. I remember across the road from our house, our neighbor's home was struck by lightning. And I remember that flash of light. And I think there's also something about the power of nature and being struck by that. And that's something I think that is very woven into being South African. That even in contexts that are incredibly urban, like Johannesburg, there is still somehow always the strength and the power of natural forces and natural elements.
Hello and welcome to the Homing In podcast. I'm Matt Gibbard, co-founder of The Modern House. Today I'm talking to the wonderful Sameya Valley, founder of the architecture and research practice Counterspace. In 2020, Sameya became the youngest ever architect to design the prestigious annual summer pavilion at the Serpentine Gallery in London, putting her alongside the likes of Zaha Hadid, Peter Zumthor and Frank Gehry. In 2021, Time magazine named her one of the 100 leaders of the future, and more recently she was artistic director of the inaugural Islamic Arts Biennale in Saudi Arabia. What really shines through in this conversation, I think, is Sameya's interest in the notion of home as it relates to place. She was born in an Indian township in Pretoria, just after Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and she cites the city of Johannesburg as her biggest inspiration. When she arrived in London, she became interested in the gathering spaces where settlers from other countries and communities have established themselves, so churches, synagogues, marketplaces, black music venues, and so on. Home is not a physical place, she says, it's a sensibility and a feeling. The name Sameya means to rise to the occasion, and she tells me how she's an outlier in her family and how her parents made sacrifices to provide her with an education. Very occasionally in life, you meet someone who has an inner light that seems to shine more brightly than other people's. And for me, Sameya certainly has that. She's incredibly composed, articulate, and wise beyond her years. And I'm full of admiration for the work she's doing to bring disparate cultures together. So here it is, and I hope you enjoy it. I wanted to start by asking about your childhood, because I read something that you said, which is you talked about your past being a series of fragments. Does that still resonate, the idea of fragments?
Yes, it does. But I think the idea of a fragment, I don't see it as negative per se. I think a fragment is a part of a whole, but by virtue of it being a small part of something greater, it almost asks us to imagine what the whole is. And from that perspective, it's very generative, because being able to resonate with a lot of different things, conditions, cultures, is very generative for me. Because, you know, if the whole picture is not visible, but we can imagine into it, I think there's something very productive about that.
I see. Okay. And so what would be the most prominent of those fragments from your childhood?
For sure, I think growing up in Lodium in South Africa, which was designated an Indian-only township by the apartheid regime, and I grew up at the end of apartheid. I was born just a few days after Mandela was released from prison.
Not fascinating.
And apartheid was really at its very end at that time, and when I was 4 years old, we became a democracy. So even though legally people of color could move into other neighborhoods by then, economically we still were the same. So people stayed, in many instances, people stayed in their communities. And even in cases where economically communities moved up, they decided to stay and to build up their communities rather than to leave. And so I grew up in a largely Indian area in Pretoria, South Africa. And I had a very community-based life in my childhood. You grew up in a small neighborhood, and our lives were very much centered around community activities, around the school, around the mosque, around charity initiatives and NGOs. There are several. I still work with several of them as well. And that energy of growing up with your neighbors, and even though it is an Indian-only area, it was very diverse in terms of religion. And somehow, I also think, thinking about it now, given some of my work and interest in the subcontinent, it's really interesting that in my childhood, the politics of India didn't play out. There were people who are Muslim, Hindu, Christian, and other, living together, respectful of each other's holidays and traditions and rituals. And I think that really also demonstrates the power of architecture, that if we live in proximity with others and if we engage with them, we realize their humanity. And that really was also the project of apartheid. It's why we were kept separate, so that we were being asked to, or being forced to, or being taught to other people based on the color of our skins. And yeah, I think realizing that later on in life has also been really profound. Then I think another aspect of my childhood and growing up that was incredibly formative is, of course, Johannesburg. My mother's family is from Johannesburg, from around Ferreras Town. And my grandfather had stores in inner city Johannesburg that are still there. And they very much became a strong part of my childhood. I spent almost every weekend and all school holidays walking in inner city Johannesburg. I used to walk from my grandfather's stores to the Johannesburg City Library and from my cousin's homes to the Mayfair Library. And I think having the experience of walking in the city as a child is also something that's incredibly special. It's also, I think, for someone who is middle class in South Africa, not very common. So I feel very lucky to have had the experience of being in the city, especially in such an incredibly vibrant place in that time of incredible optimism and change, when we really were feeling that we are the Rainbow Nation at the helm of Nelson Mandela. One really got a sense of that in the streets, in greeting all of the traders along the way and being given sweets and food by several of them, and really seeing and sensing food and trades and wares from around the world or across the continent and beyond in that space. That was something that's, I think it's very much in my consciousness or in my subconscious every time I see something or every time I approach a site. Mm-hmm.
Do you think of it as a happy time as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we were to visit Somaya aged 8, 10, what would you be doing? What were you into?
I was genuinely into everything. I remember at an early age, I was told by someone that I can't be into everything and that I had to choose.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, even at that age, that it was silly, because I had a very active outdoor life, which is an amazing thing about being in South Africa at that time. We played in the street, and I also played with all the largely boys in the neighborhood, but all the boys and girls in the neighborhood. And there was a lot of area around our home that was undeveloped. It's very different now, but at that time, I really remember walking in the felt grass with my friends and pretending to be an explorer, things that kids still do. I very much had a strong sensibility around the outdoor. Actually, my earliest memory of home, and it's probably because it wasn't traumatic for me because I didn't understand it, but it was quite a shock for a child. I remember across the road from our house, our neighbor's home was struck by lightning. And I remember that flash of light. And I think there's also something about the power of nature and being struck by that. And that's something I think that is very woven into being South African, that even in contexts that are incredibly urban, like Johannesburg, there is still somehow always the strength and the power of natural forces and natural elements. We have the most incredible thunderstorms in Johannesburg still. There's nothing like a Joburg thunderstorm in the summer. It's quite magical and quite amazing to reckon with nature in that way. I certainly enjoyed very much that about being South African, but I think the library was a very big part of my childhood, and I visited several. The Johannesburg City Library is in my mind still as a kind of magical space. It's a very old grand building. And again, I think the scale of that for a child, even when I remember it now, it's much bigger in my imagination. And seeing these endless tables piled on with fiction was very exciting for me. And I had, I think, a childhood very much attached to my wider family. I grew up with my cousins, which is something that's very common for my culture, that a family is not just the home unit, but the home unit is expansive in that it includes and is very much a part of something bigger.
That's really nice. Tell me about your parents.
They're incredible people who have worked very hard and sacrificed everything so that myself and my siblings could have an education. And I owe everything in my life to them. They're incredibly special people. They're very grounded and they're very humble. And I really also admire the inner compasses that they have, which I think comes very much from having a deep sense of an attachment to faith. And I feel very lucky to have grown up around their sense of groundedness.
That's really touching, actually, what you said there. And given how grateful you are to your parents, do you feel, as I think many people do, some sort of sense of duty to them and the way that they brought you up? And in a way, is it incumbent upon you to make something of yourself?
No, I mean, of course, I feel a sense of duty to them in terms of being a good person. I hope I'm always able to honor them in the ways that I live. But I think for my parents, the most important thing is that we are kind and happy and good people. I know that sounds simplistic, but I don't think my parents have any attachment at all to any level of material success. In fact, I'm quite an outlier, I would say, in my community, in the way that my life's panned out. I think my parents never had any expectations imposed on me, but the general trajectory for people who come from where I come from is much more orientated towards family and community life. And I still have that, but I think it's in an expansive way. And my parents have not imposed any level of judgment on that either. So yeah, I don't think I'm driven in what I do because of a sense of wanting to make something of my life for my parents.
Okay.
It sometimes feels a bit scary in that one is treading on an unknown path and have to be careful that I'm not doing anything that's going to be in conflict with my community values and where I come from.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Why are you the outlier then? Why have you chosen this path?
I haven't. I don't think I intentionally chose the path, or I still think that sometimes things choose us and we either rise to them or we turn them away. And I have always believed deeply in listening to my instinct. It's also something my parents gave me. So I'm just doing that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Were you sensitive to your environment as a child? Did it matter to you what things looked like?
Yes, always. I think I've always been very much in love with beautiful things, but also from a sensory perspective, I think I was quite sensitive. I described the felt grass and the thunderstorms and being surrounded by textiles. So I think there's also something of an experiential sensibility that was somehow very important to me. But my mother has incredible taste, and I was very lucky to also grow up around her. I remember admiring the things that my mum would choose for our home, and also her sense of personal style, which I think is also perhaps very different from a Western image, somehow the way that she combined everything in our home in terms of references that come from home, from the subcontinent, but also being in and of South Africa, and then things that were very contemporary as well. I don't know exactly where to say things came from, but I think I remember always being very much in love with design, and I wanted to be a lot of things when I was deciding what to study, but I chose architecture because of my love for design and for beauty.
And you studied architecture in South Africa, didn't you? What was that like? Because you said that it was very focused on Western architecture and ideals. Mm. Did you get a lot out of it, or did you in a way try and react against it?
Both. I had incredible teachers along the way, and I definitely enjoyed studying architecture in that it is an opening to think about everything. I think the ways that we're trained also ask us to think about things on a macro and a micro level, and there's something about envisioning that is embedded in the way that architecture is taught, I think, that I really enjoyed. And it was also the opening up of a whole new universe. My first year lecturer, Nico Puertas, used to screen films on Fridays, and they were not necessarily about architecture, they were about everything. But I think he was operating, or maybe, I don't know that he was, but it felt like he was operating very much with an awareness of the fact that people in the class were coming from many different backgrounds and had probably grown up isolated from each other, and that this was an opportunity through film and through images to really bring references to us from many different places. And he was incredibly genuine and generous in the way that he taught and in his being and in his belief in everyone. And that was incredible to be around. So I had many incredible teachers like him, and also in a very abstract way. Seeing that it was possible to be referential but be abstract and be nuanced about it was very attractive and very encouraging at that time. So there were incredible figures who taught me architecture, but I think overall architectural education on a systemic level is very much Western focused, and in our country it was very much that the West is not even looking at anymore. It was very traditional, and it is, and this is a symptom of also how the archive exists and works. We were taught a very specific and selective view of what architecture is. I didn't encounter architecture from the non-West in architecture school, really, unless it was the pyramids or Angkor Wat, but even they were taught within the paradigm of how modernism reached from them and drew on them.
Let's talk about Counter Space, your practice. What led you to founding that, and what were you trying to achieve with it? What does it stand for, would you say?
So it was formed when I was in my master's year with a group of friends in Johannesburg. And when we were studying, I think we were so excited by the city. And I think we really, as students do, were focused on and interested in what was happening in the city. And we took it upon ourselves to be in and learn from Johannesburg. And I think I felt at the time that I was going to go into architectural practice and very quickly become jaded, and that I didn't want to leave behind this love and this interest for Johannesburg. And I also felt that all of this interest and all of the challenges and inspirations that I could see in the city, the life and the blood of the city, wasn't really being translated into the canon or into the profession. And I was really intent on just having a space to pour that love for Johannesburg into and to continue a kind of research project about the city. And Counter Space was born from that. Also, I think the name has embedded this intent or this feeling that there are always counter spaces, there are always other spaces that exist alongside and next to and inside of the space that we're told is here. And Johannesburg is very much like that. It is how the city fabric is made by people through their lives and rituals and belief systems and rhythms and economies, and the actual functionings of the city exist despite the built fabric and the built infrastructure that we have.
You've recently concluded, haven't you, the first Islamic Arts Biennale, which is quite an amazing thing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience. I think it's one of those things that is a little bit like Johannesburg, comes from something that's always been a part of my life. And I never really imagined that I would have the opportunity through my work to meaningfully engage with my own community or this facet of my own community. So it's been incredible in that.
And tell us about the venue, because it was a converted airport terminal, wasn't it? A Skidmore Owings Merrill building.
Yes. So it's an incredible site. And this is the first Islamic Arts Biennale. So I was lucky enough to be a part of the project from the very beginning when the team was being formed and we were looking at sites and venues for the project. We looked at several older palaces and buildings that had connections to the Red Sea. We also before looked at several sites in Riyadh. And I think Jeddah is an incredible place for the Islamic Arts Biennale because by virtue of its port and also by virtue of the pilgrimage, it has seen and witnessed movements and migrations from the world. So in its DNA and in its culture, it has really embodied cultures from around the world. And it's also transmitted its own culture everywhere across the globe. And so I think several of the sites that we looked at were seeking to embody this. And the airport terminal is this incredible site. It's actually not even defunct, it's in use.
Okay.
So there is the functioning airport terminal, and then across the road from it, there is this unused land parcel. And the Skidmore, Owings and Merrill structure essentially is an airport terminal building and then these large-scale umbrella canopies that recede into the distance into infinity. And on our site, there are still the umbrella canopies. And there was nothing else there but sand and these canopies. And when we first visited the site, I remember being flooded with memories of being there as a 14-year-old pilgrim and seeing the entire world gathering and coming together. It's really unusual for an airport in that it's designed for people to wait, but not for them to buy anything. And people really wait in that site sometimes for 12, 14 hours a day. And everybody who's coming to that site is coming there with the purpose of pilgrimage. And especially at Hajj time, one really gets that sense and that feeling. And that's a very intelligent part of the design, is that you're immersed in the sense of community. And I think that feeling and that energy of being a part of something that is so huge, that is symbolically so united, but also so incredibly diverse, is in the energy of the project and in my intention for the first Islamic Arts Biennale. And the site was incredibly formative in guiding the concept as well.
It's so clear that you're very interested in bringing cultures together.
Mm-hmm.
Architecture, as we know, is traditionally a very male-dominated, white, quite close-minded community. And you're a real flag bearer, aren't you, in a way, because you're a young female Muslim from an Indian township in South Africa. Is your rise to prominence a sign that things are changing a bit? How do you assess that?
I hope so. I mean, it must be. I recognize that I'm standing on the shoulders of so many others who made this space possible for me. I think also as a South African, I feel very deeply, you know, I spoke about the sacrifices my parents made and their lack of access to education. And I'm aware that spaces like this would not have been open to me years before, especially as a South African, but I think broadly speaking in the world context as well. So it is changing, perhaps too slowly. And sometimes, I will say, I get the feeling that things are changing on the surface, but real change is still very difficult. Because I think if you're communicating through your work systemic change, and one is working to bring about a different voice, a different sensibility, different aesthetics that are not directly communicating something about representation, but on a deeper and more nuanced level, I hope my work is working to manifest something about our identities. Architecture is very abstract. We don't look around and think this comes from predominantly white, Western, male-dominated, heteronormative visions, but it does. And in the same way, I think if we think about other origins and other starting points, they go through a process of abstraction in architecture, and they should, I think. When things really move us, it's because they have that level of abstraction. They become a kind of language that people can interpret, and then they touch us in a very deep way. And if we're communicating that indirectly, it's very difficult to communicate it with for clients to buy into something that is so different from what they expect or what they see is difficult. And I think on that level, just in terms of the challenges I face day to day, I don't know that things are changing quickly enough.
What kind of challenges?
Being able to communicate different vision to people who then need to buy into that, and also an understanding of why that's important. Because I think people might feel that it's important to have different voices in the room, but on a subconscious level, are we ready to ask those different voices to bring different vision, or do we just want to placate ourselves and say we have these different voices, so we've done the work and we've checked the box?
Yeah.
It's the same as this essay by Richard Rorty, and it's called Feminism and Pragmatism. And it describes the US justice system and says that it's doubly oppressive for women to be coming into a justice system where they then have to perpetuate violence onto women. And that's what I'm saying. Of course, it's a start to have representation and representative voices. But we have to be asking for a change in system, and we have to be ready for the fact that systems should look differently to what they do now, in order not only to include voices of difference, but really to center different visions and to think about how our architectures, our systems, our institutions really need to be resonant with all of us.
Mm. What about on an aesthetic level? Do you see architecture being a confluence of those various cultures coming together?
Yes, and I think I also aesthetically, actually across the board, really believe in hybridity. And as much as I'm saying voices of difference need to be centered, I don't believe that excludes voices who have been dominant forever, because we all are hybrid. And when you described my identity just now, every time I hear it back, even though it's not something I've ever foregrounded myself, I'm very aware of how hyphenated my identity is and how many places and cultures my own identity is resonant with. And what I described about growing up in a multi-faith situation, I think is true for everyone. If we do come together and we are in close enough proximity with others, we really start to understand the resonance between our cultures. There is specificity and there is nuance and there is difference that's there to be celebrated. But there are also points of reference and intersection that resonate with everybody.
That's interesting. Let's move on to the present day. Where do you currently live and what's it like?
I live between London and South Africa. In Johannesburg, I live alone with my grandmother in a very leafy suburb that's lined with jacaranda trees for a few weeks in October, November. It's really beautiful, and I have an incredible drive to the studio in Braamfontein. It's about an 8-minute drive, and in that drive I cross many different worlds and lives and bubbles that Johannesburg contains. And I often think about all the thresholds of moving through the traffic lights and moving through so many socioeconomic worlds in that one drive. We used to have a studio space in Jeppestown, and that is an 8-minute drive from my home in the other direction. Also crosses through completely different worlds. And in terms of the sensory worlds that it embodies and the textures of what it means to be South African, it's something that I'm reminded of every day on my drive to work and to the studio. It is incredibly beautiful in terms of the natural environments that one moves through. But being middle class again, I also live on a street that has very high fences and boundary walls and no sense of neighborliness on an urban level. And then moving into the city and seeing trade at the intersections, there's also the universities on both sides, Wits and Doornfontein, and really also seeing students from so many different backgrounds commute in the city. And seeing people try to make a life in Johannesburg is always very grounding, seeing trade and the life of the city, and also homelessness and being reminded of some of the challenges that we have in Johannesburg. And then coming to Jeppestown or Braamfontein and really feeling this mix of so many things coming together at once, this incredible life and vibrancy that there is in Johannesburg. And in London, I live in South Kensington at the moment, extremely different. But on a day like today, actually, walking past Hyde Park is not dissimilar to the colour and quality of light that there is in Johannesburg. I live not far from the Serpentine, which is also a symbolic home for me in London.
Well, tell us about that then, because I mean, I'd like to come back to Johannesburg, but yeah, you did famously did a beautiful Serpentine Pavilion, which is an annual celebration of architecture where someone is asked to design and build a pavilion in the grounds of the gallery. You were the youngest ever person to do that, weren't you, I think? What was that like when that call came in?
I think I made a conscious effort not to let it be stressful. And I had an awareness that I was being asked to make a submission. I think there were several people who were asked to make a submission that year. And that it meant that it would be stepping into very large shoes and in a legacy of Zaha Hadid and Peter Zumthor and Sufa Jamoto and so many people that I really look up to. But I really tried to think, what does someone like me from my context have to say about architecture? And even then, I believe that I have a lot to say from my perspective and that we have a lot to say from our part of the world. And I wanted the pavilion to be about that. But I had to think, at that point, my practice was so centered around Johannesburg, around finding design form and design language and creative expression for all these incredible phenomena that we have in our city. And it's a very place-based approach to design. And I started to think about that for London. So I really wanted to reflect London back to London. And I started to look at waves of migration in London, which of course is the story of London itself. And I became really interested in places of home and of belonging for people when they first moved to London. So some of the first mosques, African churches, synagogues, but then also marketplaces where people were able to find traditional ingredients that were important to recipes, or community centers for women where people looked after each other's children or came together to find work and to share networks and connections. Some of the first cinemas where people could hear something in their mother tongue, or some of the first venues to play black music. So several places like this. And I started to map them out. And for me, these places have also strengthened my sense of home in London. Notting Hill, which is not very far from where I live, and the Tabernacle has really become also a stronghold for my sense of place in London. And the pavilion is an amalgamation and an abstraction of these gestures of generosity that the architectures had. So, for example, there was a very flat seating section at one of the entrances to the pavilion that drew on an iftar scenario when the Grenfell protest happened, and there was just a surface that was rolled out onto the street and people came around to gather and break their fast at the time of the Grenfell silent marches. And porch steps in Brixton, and that these became places for people to gather and organize around the time of the Brixton riots. Several of these gestures I started to look at and work with, and the spaces in the pavilion work to embody these as gathering spaces and to honor their legacy as gathering spaces by bringing them into the present for people to gather around. And on an architectural level, it worked so that there were smaller sections for intimate conversations, for a one-to-one discussion, or for a workshop scenario. But then as a whole, all of these fragments really came together as a larger gathering structure. And we held several performances. We also invited some of the community arts institutions that we were involved with to host gatherings in the pavilion. I really wanted it to be a folding of London into the pavilion, and then the most important thing was that it was also a folding of the pavilion out into London. And we worked to place some of the fragments of the pavilion into some of the community arts institutions that inspired it. And this project has really embedded for me a sense of home in London.
And your place in South Kensington, who do you live there with?
Just myself.
Okay. Do you like living on your own?
I haven't. I can't say I've lived on my own in it yet, because the last years have been so busy with travel. And really, I think there's a big part of my practice that embeds itself in a context and in a project I'm working on. And I have been in Jeddah for 10 days a month for the last 2 years. And for the last 5 months before the project opened, I was there nonstop. And post that, when it opened, I also was a part of the life of the project and its programming and initiatives. And beyond Jeddah, I think the last 2 years have just been incredibly busy with travel. So I haven't yet been able to feel a sense of living at home alone in South Kent. I moved from Marylebone, and it's quite different. So, yeah, I'm excited to get to know it.
Okay, so you'll be on your own there. And when you're in Johannesburg, you're with your grandmother.
Yes.
Why do you live with her?
I think it just happened because the... culturally, the way that we live is always tied to family. And I was studying and, of course, working in Johannesburg. And I stayed with my grandmother because of her proximity to the university and the studio. But it was also incredibly special for me to have this time with her, and that she has such a big presence in my life. She's always had. She's a really big matriarchal personality. And I feel very lucky to have shared this time with her also.
It's really nice. So you describe yourself then as someone that travels a lot and you have homes many thousands of miles apart. As a result, how would you define what home is in your life? What does that word home mean to you?
I think it's become abstract, and I think it's something that we carry inside ourselves, and they are touchstones of home in many different places and many different contexts. I think South Africa will always be home because of how formative it has been in making me who I am. But at the same time, I really feel and resonate with so many contexts and so many conditions. I think home is where someone feels they belong. And in that sense, London is very much home because I never feel like I'm not from here. The incredible thing about London is that it is so diverse, that we encounter people from so many different places, and one never imagines that they're not from London, which is really wonderful. It's such a place of so many different places. And I think there are things about several contexts that I visit that I resonate deeply with. I've recently been working in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, and in Sylhet, and I've been taken by how familiar so much of the language is to me. There are many overlaps with Gujarati, which my grandmother speaks, but also in terms of food and in terms of how familial culture is. There's so much resonance there. I also recently have visited Sri Lanka. I stayed at number 11, Jeffrey Bauer's house, and I'm working on a project with the Jeffrey Bauer Trust at the moment. And again, in terms of context, cultural condition, there is so much resonance with who I am in that context as well. So I think home is also something expansive, and where we feel we belong, all the touch points that remind us of who we are and that resonate with our memories and resonate with things deep inside of us really contribute to that sense of home. So I think I have, for the moment, suspended the idea that home is a physical place. It's a sensibility and a feeling.
That's fascinating. If you could, though, describe the physicality of it, and let's move on to the future now. If I could ask you to throw a set of ingredients into a pot and come out with some sort of physical structure that you would love to live in, what might that look like?
I think being at number 11, Jeffrey Bauer's house, was very inspiring in how much the outside is inside. And I think in many subcontinental and African languages, the word environment is a kind of non-concept, because there's no such thing as something being outside of us. And there's something so intelligent in how Bawa really blurred the weather line. There was a thunderstorm and it was inside of the house. There are trees that are outside and inside so much of the home. And I found that really beautiful, that proximity to the natural elements and being so much in touch with the climate. And the house is also very cool climatically. I visited during, it was May when I was there. And there's something about that sensibility that I wish architecture would be more in tune with, rather than seeing itself as an envelope for keeping the outside or the elements out. I think Johannesburg, of course, in terms of all of the texture and all of the atmospheres that it brings, also in how it embodies how different cultures live. For example, what a seating arrangement for Johannesburg would look like. I envision my future home to have an endless table or an endless iftar surface, to quote the Serpentine Pavilion, that people from all walks of life can gather around and really share. And I think being in Jeddah has been incredibly formative as well, just in terms of the sheer hybridity that the city holds, and also in how it somehow has always been very contemporary. It somehow has managed to reach into something that's deeply ancestral and hold on to it, but in the at the same time welcome cultures from around the world in its DNA.
What kind of landscape do you respond most to?
I want to say the sub-Saharan landscape, but I also have really responded to port cities and the sea and tropical environments as well.
Okay, so you're not fussy.
No, but I'm sure there's some connection with all of these places somewhere deep in my DNA.
But would you say that you're an urban dweller, or would you ideally like to live quite remotely?
I told you in the beginning of the conversation that I believe we can have everything. And I think the future is going to become more and more hybrid. So I think rural environments are going to start to become more urban. And I hope that urban environments start to, and they really should, think about the rural and the natural a lot more integrally. When I described Bawa's house, it is in Colombo, in the city, but behind closed doors, one will never know. You feel like you're really in a sanctuary, which is incredible. So maybe it could be split, and we could have a side that faces either and both.
I like it. How do you see the future of architecture taking shape, would you say?
I think I've expressed now that I hope that it's going to be more hybrid, and that we somehow think about the outside as more an integral part of what we're doing on the inside. And of course, that's going to become more and more difficult with the fact that our planet is heating at such a rapid rate. But I think it's also more important to think about an architecture that lives with conditions rather than stands to hold up against them. Again, when I was recently in Bangladesh for this project, the theme of the project that I was working on was around Bona or flood. And it really thinks about how ancient communities in that region lived with the flood as a part of their life. They saw it as something that was another being, the same as they were. And architectures and structures were designed not to withstand the flood, but to live with it. And I think that there's something about that, about this idea of being adaptive, that architecture really needs to respond to, rather than thinking about it only as a problem that we need to find a solution to.
I ask most of our guests this, which is, I'm going to ask you to fast forward towards the latter years of your life, and you're very young, so this might be a bit difficult, but when you look back over everything that you've done in your later life, how do you want to see things panning out, and what do you hope that you'll be most proud of you having achieved or done?
I don't know. I think it's very important always maybe to think about the question the other way around. As a young person, I often get asked by other young people and younger people about paradigms of success, or how did you go from being in Johannesburg to working on the Serpentine Pavilion, for example. And I find those questions very misdirected and very depressing. Because I really believe that we shouldn't be focused on material successes and achievements. We should really be thinking, you know, I said earlier that I'm standing on the shoulders of so many who came before. And on one of the projects I'm working on in Belgium at the moment, it was a simple brief for a pedestrian bridge. And through my research on the project, we uncovered the history of this incredible figure whose name is Paul Panda Fanana, who came from this town that the brief comes from. It's called Vilvoorde. And he was a horticulturalist. He studied in the town, passed with distinction, and contributed to what the landscape of Belgium looks like. Subsequently went back to the Congo and also contributed to what the landscape of the Congo looks like. He was incredibly politically active. He fought for Belgium in the war and experienced firsthand the terrible discrimination against black people and people from the Congo who fought for Belgium. He spoke out against this and he advocated for the wages and the rights of black people to be more fair. He did so much work. And arguably, he affected real change, and he's been completely unrecognized. And our proposal works to honor him in drawing on water architectures from the Congo. So when you look at these images of these dug-out boats on the Congo, and you see them stacked together, they become platforms for people to gather and trade, and they become almost like little communal architectures. And I was very inspired by that. So the bridge is a series of stacked boats that kind of hug each other and cling together. And each of them is planted with species that come from Fanana's research. So they become a little reflection garden in honor of him and his life's work. Subsequent to the proposal, I don't know if it's coincidental or if it's because of the project, but there have been stories in the newspapers. Who was Paul Panda Fanana? And there is now a lot of excitement in the public to learn who he was, to learn more about his life and so on. I'm talking about this long story to say, you know, there's that saying about societies flourish when old men plant seeds, the shade of which they will never sit in. I hope that it's possible in our lifetimes to affect change. But I think that thinking about this long game, longer project of the work that we have to do and the seeds that we're planting now and what that will mean for the future is really important. I don't know on any level what kind of material achievements I will have effected by the end of my life, but I do see myself in a continuum of change, and I hope that some of the work that I'm doing will honor those who came before me and will hopefully make space for those coming after in the same way that space was made for me to be able to do this work.
Do you know the phrase nominative determinism? Have you come across that?
Yes.
So it's this idea that your name somehow determines the person that you become.
Yes.
And I say that because my wife's name is Faye Toogood. Okay, so imagine having the name Toogood. It's a lot to live up to.
Yes.
And as a result, she's been very ambitious for herself, I think. We worked with this brilliant wildflower specialist whose name is Charles Flower.
Okay,
he's one of the leading specialists in wildflower meadows.
Yes.
There are so many examples of this. There's
yes.
Isabella Tree, the environmental.
Yes.
And
yes.
so on. Your name, Sameya,
yeah.
means to rise.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. So in Islamic cultures, naming is incredibly important. And there are three rights that an unborn child has over their parents. One of them is to receive a good name, because we also believe very much in this idea of nominative determinism, that you come with a name and that has a bearing on your life. So Sumeya means to rise to the occasion. And my surname, Valley, was changed several times over history. So I believe it comes from Vali, from when my family was in India. And before that, it comes from Wali, or the concept of a Wali, which means saint in Arabic. I don't know if that's depressing, but yes, those are the meanings of my names. And my mother was incredibly inspired by the story of one of the companions of the Prophet Muhammad. Her name was Sumayya, radiallahu anha. May she be elevated in her next life. But the story goes that she was a woman of very strong faith, and she was being tortured and tormented to give up her faith, and she refused to do so. And she died in a very gruesome way, very romantic also. There were ropes attached to each of her legs, and she was pulled apart until her body split. And she's the first person to have died for her faith in the early times of Islam. And because we believe so much in nominative determinism, I always joke with my mother that it's her fault that I'm so stubborn, because she gave me this name, and I'm named after this incredibly strong-minded woman.
Well, I think more to the point, you have risen to every occasion. Maybe that's the key to your incredible rise. So it's been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Such an honour.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Sumayya. Good to meet you.
So lovely to meet you. Thank you. That was wonderful. That was so much fun.
Thank you to Sumayya, and thanks very much to all of you for listening. As always, you can head over to the Modern House website to see some photos, and we'll put a link in the show notes. If you're enjoying Homing In and would like to hear more episodes, please tap on the follow button and they will magically appear as soon as they get released. This episode was produced by Hannah Phillips and edited by Oscar Crawford. The music is by Father. Thanks again, and talk to you on the next one. Bye for now.